Welcome to the latest episode of Take Back Our Schools. I'm Andrew Gutman. I'm joined, as I always am, with my co-host Beth Feely. And we are two accidental activist parents that spoke up about what was going on in our children's schools. And we are very fortunate to have our guest today, James Lindsay. I think a lot of our listeners will be familiar with James's work. But for those that are not, he is by orders of magnitude, and for those non-mathematicians, that means by a lot, the most knowledgeable person about the ideological foundations of everything we call woke. He is the founder of New Discourses. He's the author or co-author of a number of books, including Cynical Theories, Race, Marxism, and most recently, The Marxification of Education. So James, thank you so much for taking time and joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
So let's start kind of big picture. Your sort of thesis, I think, in The Marxification of Education, your thesis more broadly, is that the fundamental mission of schools has changed, and parents are really not aware of that. Is that an accurate assessment? I don't want to say more than that, because I want to let you talk about it. But is that an accurate assessment that the mission of schools in America, K through 12, has really changed, and that this has happened without parents really knowing and understanding what's going on?
Yes, but I would like to put a finer point on it. It's in fact, as I put in the subtitle of the book, it is in fact that education has been stolen from parents and their children, and thus from our society. And I think that's a very important way to look at it. And so the Marxification of Education outlines Paulo Freire. He's a Brazilian Marxist theologian, really, educator, kind of hodgepodge guru character. And he came up with a method of education that enabled left-wing activists, specifically Marxist-type activists, to swap out educational content for political consciousness raising while retaining kind of the outer shape. And thus, it's truly a theft of education. Now, as a result of that, the mission of education has been completely changed in line with Freire's agenda, which is the education for him, a true education, he says, should be what he calls a political education. It should raise what he calls political literacy rather than the kind of literacy that allows you to succeed and build upon the existing society that he wishes was torn down. And so what you do have is a complete transformation into what of education's goal into Marxist, as he calls it, conscientization, the awakening of political consciousness from a Marxist perspective. And he uses existing subject matter, in his words, as a mediator to that political knowledge. So a math lesson, a history lesson, you know, we all know about the 1619 project now with history. Those become excuses to have political conversations with children and thus steal the educational content and replace it with, we sometimes say indoctrination, but I think programming is a more accurate word. Mm-hmm.
So what is the end game then? Is it revolution? Is it utopia? Like what are they aiming for?
Well, if we take Paulo Freire at his word, it's not only revolution, but what he calls perpetual revolution. He warns explicitly in virtually all of his works that if the revolution were to at any point stop, it would become a new status quo that would immediately need to be criticized in the Marxist sense and torn down. And so it's actually far worse. It's perpetual chaos. So the end goal is, in fact, to turn. I should just back up one step. In his earliest writings, he geared toward adult literacy education, but by his later writings, he's including writing about children explicitly in K through 12 years, as his work had gotten picked up by colleges of education by that point. He's explicitly aiming so that students, and thus in this case, children, are to be turned into the kind of activists who, in his words, denounce the existing world such that it announces the possibility of a different world, which is kind of what we see happening with our children. It's to turn our children into activists for these particular causes. It's to teach them that the most important lessons in their lives are the political lessons as framed through Marxist theory. And this varies because different factions pick it up and do different things with it. Paulo Freire was explicitly revolutionary. He held up as an exemplar of his philosophy, Che Guevara, who was a violent revolutionary. In fact, he calls what Che Guevara did Che Guevara's witness, in very religious terms. And he says, though, that you don't have to take up that specific witness in order to testify to the revolutionary changes. Other people are less overtly revolutionary. They're more of the kind of Fabian incremental subversive change from within, and they eschew revolution. But the goal in any case is a utopian, and that's Freire's explicit word, a utopian vision for a world that is now devoid of the dehumanizing forms, domesticating modes, et cetera, that are perpetrated by bourgeois classes, whether that's material, financial bourgeoisies, like the rich, the capitalists, and so on, or whether that's cultural bourgeoisie, like whites and straight and male and so on, you know, the different identity factors that we've all become sadly familiar with over the last few years.
I know that, and you've written this, I mean, Paulo Freire is widely read in the education schools. I think Pedagogy of the Oppressed, his most famous book, is one of, if not the most widely read book in education schools. So the you know, teachers or in their training are getting this kind of material. Do you think, are they really aware? Do most teachers really want a revolution? Or do they just think they're doing something good? A new way of teaching or you know, history is, we need to teach history differently than we used to teach it. I mean, do they know they're putting a revolution in place here?
My guess is, certainly the answer is that some of them do, because they write it. So my guess is, from kind of some statistics I picked up across industry, from some things that I've heard that I'm just kind of spitballing, probably about 3-5% of teachers actually are consciously aware that they're pursuing a revolutionary ideology, and probably 95-ish, maybe plus percent, but in that range, believe they're doing something good, that they are teaching the secrets of history that were being hid for dirty political reasons, like maintaining white supremacy and so on. So the majority of teachers, I honestly have to say, are not the enemy. But we have explicit admissions, not just from some teachers themselves that have come out in various exposés, but also from the consultants that often work for these kind of nonprofit organizations that deliver these kinds of materials. We have the explicit naming of the program being that they try to get a small percentage of the teachers in any given school and of the administration in any given school or district to become what they call, and I quote, co-conspirators. Those people blatantly know what they're doing. The definition they give for co-conspirators are people who know what they're doing and are willing to break the law to do it if necessary to advance the agenda. So these people are willfully participating in something they know is wrong, or at least that is, they think it's morally right, but legally wrong, and are willing to take the risk of, you know, possibly fines or jail time as a result. So we know that some of the teachers, but we also know, statistically speaking, that you don't need that many activists within an organization, because most people go along to get along. Most people don't buck the trend. Most people aren't that aware in looking into the depths of it. They've got enough to do with their lives. You don't need that many activists. I've read in the past in the environmental movement, they made cases that it was 3.5%. If you have 3.5% of a population dedicated to a cause, you can probably flip over an entire institution or an entire society. That's not a very large percentage. And it's on the order of magnitude of the current estimates. Because like you said, Paulo Freire's work, Pedagogy of the Oppressed being his magnum opus, is held in pride of place in virtually every college of education in North America. He is the third most cited author in all of the social sciences and humanities. To give you some idea, even though most people have never heard of him, of his impact within the domains where he's relevant, the total number of citations, I just saw this yesterday from my friend Wokal Distance putting it out on Twitter, the total number of citations lifetime over all academic articles that are high enough to cross whatever threshold these rating agencies use, that Albert Einstein, who I think a few people have heard of, he has something like 126,000 citations, which is a large number of citations. Paulo Freire's is something like 430,000. It's something like almost four times as many.
Yeah.
At least three times as many.
And so he has had a huge impact and an influence. And I wanted to go back to these consulting groups that are in the schools, some of which are very much for profit. So there might be a couple of nons, but some of them make an awful lot of money for themselves. So these are trainings like people are going to see, like Beyond Diversity for example, is one of them, and groups like Panorama that put out a lot of SEL surveys and things like that. So that is a sign of kind of this influence that you're seeing in these institutions that are absolutely redirecting them.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So how did we get here? Like, how did this happen? Kind of under the radar, I think it seems, to a lot of parents and possibly even some educators who didn't sign up necessarily for the revolution.
Well, frankly, the strategy was very simple. It's been given the name, the Long March Through the Institutions. That's a coinage of Rudy Deutschke in 1966. Rudy Deutschke was actually looking at what Mao Zedong was achieving in China when he gave it this name. He was explicitly a Marxist. Herbert Marcuse, another very influential Marxist in the 60s, basically kind of the godfather of, I'll be more specific than usual, the academic New Left, not just the radical New Left that he was kind of leading, you know, intellectually leading through the 50s and 60s. It culminated in the riots and eruption in 67, 8, and 9. But also, he explicitly became kind of a godfather of the academic New Left as that kind of more radical version died out. These guys, he calls in his 1972 work for a march into the institutions, and in particular, education, as he says, at all levels. And so you have this kind of a call to march in. So the strategy was, if you can capture the colleges of education, then you capture the creation of teachers. And then a generation later, you capture a generation of students. Meanwhile, you're still deepening the next generation of teachers through an increasing process of teaching them, you know, what's called critical pedagogy based off of Freire's work. And so if you get the colleges of education, you get the teachers. And if you get the teachers, you get the students. And if you get the students, you get the future. And that was a generational program started in the 1960s, quite deliberately, moving into academia quite vigorously into the early 1970s, but especially as the Reagan administration took over through the early 1980s. And so they started to create a broad agenda at the universities to start getting people placed explicitly, to get people tenured, get Marxists tenured in colleges of education. One activist an educator by the name of Henry Giroux, he's still alive, he's still very active, he's openly a communist, claimed that his most valuable praxis after being radicalized by Freire's work was to go around and get 100 professors tenured at colleges of education between the late 1970s and 1984, so that when Paulo Freire's 1985 book was published, it's called Politics of Education, it was rampantly picked up by colleges of education, such that as another Marxist educator by the name of Isaac Gottesman, who was at Iowa State, said in his book, The Critical Turn in Education, so that Paulo Freire's influence was where it remains today, which is to say everywhere, that's his words, by 1992. So okay, they captured the colleges of education. Meanwhile, frankly, conservatives decided, well, there shouldn't be government schools anyway, so let's just ignore it. Let's just, you know, bang a drum about school choice or something and leave education to people who want government influence, which created the kind of, and of course, they're getting squeezed out of universities and the same kind of attitude. Well, if they don't want us, we'll take our toys and go home kind of attitude led to a situation where these colleges of education, the accrediting bodies, the licensing bodies, everything to do with education, I emphasize again, it became very important to them under the Reagan administration to say, you know what, we've lost all of our cultural power, so now we're going to take the schools. And nobody paid attention. We were all asleep at the wheel. People think, well, Reagan's in charge, things are going great, he's very conservative, you know, blah, blah, blah. And these guys were worming their way into the key institutions like universities, licensing bodies, accreditation bodies, and so on at the time.
It's interesting. I was talking with a friend yesterday that, you know, I was saying, you know, my kids go to the same schools I went to, but they are different. And the timing that you mentioned, I got out of the K-12 system in the late 80s. And so if that's about when some of this change was taking, a lot of it hadn't taken root and hadn't been influencing the education I got. But by the time my kids got through the schools, it has, the seeds have been planted, and there are definitely shoots, if not a harvest coming.
Well, I had a different experience. I mean, I'm around the same time. I grew up in a very liberal town. It's actually in New Jersey. It's actually the first town in the country to voluntarily desegregate. They were very heavy into what they called multicultural education. which is effectively cultural relativism, which is to say you can't say one culture, you can't say Western culture is better than another. We would spend, I remember, you know, 3 or 4 weeks on the Harlem Renaissance and one day on World War I or World War II. I mean, so this was already going on in my public education in the 80s. And I think, I mean, I don't know if you know, that's it. This is not just a straight line down. I mean, there were various steps. You had the 60s you talked about, you had the 80s that you talked about, and then you had this social justice more recently, and that maybe when the final switch went off. But this is, to your point, been going on, you know, a long time.
No, there's been a shotgun blast, actually, in a sense, because you bring up the multicultural education that was actually quite popular. You mentioned in New Jersey, but kind of the Atlantic states, the New England states. But in California, starting in, I think, 68, honestly, it may have been that early, but somewhere in this vicinity, give or take a few years, doesn't matter that much. There was already an explicit push at the level of the state, which was not, California was not particularly left in the 60s and 70s. There was already an explicit push to include an ethnic studies curriculum at the University of California. And so it came under multicultural education. It came under umbrellas like ethnic studies. And these things were happening in various enclaves very early on through this. These were like kind of experiments to see what worked and what could get cobbled into. And what we think of now as woke or what, diversity, equity, inclusion, whatever, all kind of locked into and kind of colonized these projects. And they were already radical to begin with. I'm not saying they were necessarily even these great things. They were radical to begin with, but they've really been co-opted and taken in a particular direction under a particular mantle. Another project that started in 1968 was the so-called Whole Child Education Program that started in Connecticut. And that has become part of the foundation of what ended up becoming social emotional learning today, which by 2015, because I have a document sitting here open on my desk, on my laptop in front of me right now, it was explicitly Freirean in its orientation. Linda Darling Hammond said so in the foreword she wrote to the Handbook of Social Emotional Learning in 2015, that to be a socially and emotionally competent school means to have adopted Freire's program of humanization and transformation, which is explicitly Marxist.
So going back to the shift in education, this is also when you're starting, when you see, because all of this has, it takes up time. So it's the, what's going out the door is kind of the Western canon and what we might call a more classical approach. Do you see that coming back, or do you, what's your take on how valuable that is? And is that a way that we can try to combat some of this that's happening in the schools?
It's not going to come back organically. We need to assert it back into the space. What's happening is a very, so in communism, there's a strategy. We usually think of it in terms of institutions, for instance, policing, that's called entryism or sometimes just entrism. And the idea is what you do is it's out with the old, in with the new. That's the idea. You create reasons to start to purge people who are undesirable. Say you force them to get a shot or something, or they can't keep their job. You put, that's in the military. In policing, you make it just an intolerable racial situation, constantly accuse them. A lot of people retire. It's very contentious. It's, and everybody hates them, so they retire. And then you install policies for hiring new people that are extremely strict, the DEI hiring policies, et cetera. We just saw the results of that in Memphis. Catastrophe, of course. But this is a very common thing. Well, it turns out that the entryism programs happened in education as well. There's a straight line, and I kid you not, to, in deep ways to Paulo Freire, under the name of decolonizing the curriculum or decolonizing science, decolonizing books, decolonizing, decolonizing, decolonizing. Decolonizing, a lot of people who are in the know will trace back to a character named Franz Fanon, who is from Martinique. He spoke French, which is a French colony, and he's talking about decolonization literally in violent terms, that decolonization, he says explicitly in The Wretched of the Earth, is a violent process, blah, blah, blah. And they're not wrong to, because what does Paulo Freire cite over and over again? Well, he cites The Wretched of the Earth, The Wretched of the Earth, The Wretched of the Earth. He alludes to this constantly. He's very informed by this mentality. Well, I mentioned a disciple of Freire, Henry Giroux, but there's another, he's also now dead. His name was Joe Kinchelow. He was at McGill University in Canada, and he is the progenitor using the Freirean approach. By the way, Freire started not as a Marxist, but as a post-colonialist, hence his interest in Fanon. He cites explicitly off of Freire's work what has become the decolonize the curriculum program. That's Joe Kinchelow's project in the early 2000s. And so the decolonize the curriculum, as you said, is it exists to basically take a crowbar and pry up the Western canon to say that it reasserts, you know, cultural values that are harmful, that have done harm, blah, 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 the whole rigmarole we're all used to. And then to replace it with what Freire would identify as generative materials. It's not just that you're going to pry up Shakespeare and stick in a Black author. It's that you're going to stick in an author that's Black who also presents materials that force you to have political conversations about Marxist political Blackness, or in other words, critical race theory. That's the kind of, or it could be the same thing with, you're going to pry up Mark Twain and you're going to stick in genderqueer so you can have conversations about sex and sexuality under the LGBTQ plus manipulative umbrella. And so this is a program that was outlined by Freire that was then distilled into something very actionable by one of his later disciples named Joe Kinchelow. Joe Kinchelow, by the way, is also academically known for outlining what is, based off of Freire and his other readings of the so-called European theorists, what is known as critical constructivist epistemology, which is like 11 million syllables of academese that actually literally mean woke. When I first read about that back in 2016 or 17, I was like, oh my gosh, I found the definition of woke. It's called critical constructivist epistemology. And I remember putting this out into the world and people saying, nobody knows what you're talking about, shut up. Well, it turns out that it's a disciple of Freire who codified woke officially under this approach, and he attached it to the kind of engine of his decolonizer curriculum. So if we want to see the Western canon come back, the first thing we have to be able to do is diagnose why it's being displaced, which is in fact a deliberate program called decolonizing the curriculum. We have to put a halt to that program. We have to make that program distasteful to people. The second they see that long word that starts with a D, decolonize, they have to say, no, this is what the, they probably won't say it this way, but this is what the German cultural Marxists called Aufheben der Kultur, which is abolish the culture, abolish the existing culture so you can replace it with a new one. And no, and therefore we're going to stick with the great books of the Western canon. We are going to not colonize or decolonize the curriculum at all. We are going to maintain the curriculum. And you have to be able to do that to sidestep the language. It's not about colonizing or decolonizing. That's your so-called dialectical trap you get in that argument. Oh, you wanted to colonize the curriculum. No, you want to decolonize. No, no, no. We're going to maintain the curriculum because the curriculum is valuable and good and stands on its merits. And we have to start unapologetically making that argument and being able to call out the thing that we have to be able to basically find and grab the crowbar that they're using to pry up the Western canon, take it out of their hands, and then probably remove those people from positions where they have any opportunity to use some other tool later under a different brand name.
But this decolonizing the curriculum goes beyond just the Western canon. It goes beyond just your English curriculum, your reading lists, and your history curriculum.
Oh, yeah.
They have decolonizing math and science gigantic. And art. And I mean, can you talk a little bit about how this is, what this looks like, you know, outside of just the obviously English and history that most people talk about?
Yes. Usually in English and history, you're going to hear what I just talked about primarily. When you get into the mathematics, into the science, what you're usually going to find is that the thing that they, so they use programs like decolonizing math or ethnomathematics is usually a brand name. There's a particularly crazy woman. I encourage people to look her up and look up her papers. Her name is Rochelle Gutierrez. She's insane. She's very explicitly clear about what she wants. And she's created a so-called ethnomathematics approach that she calls mathematesh, which is, that's how you say it, but it's mathemat. As if you're going to spell mathematics and you get to the T and then you just put an X. There's not even another vowel, just mathemat X, and it's pronounced mathematesh. This woman openly says it's not enough to have equity in math. We have to have revolution. She says it over and over and over again. I mean, she's talking about how we need to learn math from plants. I mean, this is insane. This woman's really worth looking into. She's also very influential in decolonizing math. This is a huge initiative in the Pacific Northwest. And what you find is when they wedge this stuff up, what they put in as a placeholder is indigenous. It's always right, to get right back to indigeneity. So
decolonize and re-indigenize.
That's right.
Use those together, right?
Those are together. That's right. To re-indigenize. That's exactly the other side of the coin. And so what you find is the algebra class gets replaced with learning how to make bead patterns and talking about how perhaps, you know, algebra was invented in the Middle East and white people stole it. Europeans stole algebra through violent conquest, which isn't true. They were having their own problems. They were actually in the Middle East at the so-called House of Wisdom or whatever it was called. They actually were descending back into religious tyranny. And some of it ended up making its way over to Italy and became very profitable for bankers who then imported a lot of that mathematics. But that's the real story. The so-called Leonardo da Pisa, who people know as Fibonacci, was actually integral in this story. And that's why he becomes famous in history, as it turns out. But they teach these kinds of very political wedge lessons and then try to bring in, you know, indigenous mathematics or indigenous science, which is ultimately, you know, mythology and kind of a little bit of rudimentary number theory and a little bit of rudimentary pattern identification or symmetry finding and all of this kind of thing, and replace it with actually learning what we identify as mathematics, arithmetic, getting into algebra, getting into calculus, under the brand name of, like I said, ethno-mathematics, which is a form of decolonizing mathematics. You see it in the sciences. What radicalized me, I did a podcast actually going through this, was the attempt. There was a paper written in 2016. What brought me, like, what was the thing that triggered you to do all this, James? I get asked that a lot. There were a lot of pieces, you know, you build up, and finally something pushes you over the edge. Well, it was a paper written on $500,000 almost of National Science Foundation money, came out of the University of Oregon, that was about feminist glaciology, the study of glaciers from a feminist perspective, or else the science is sexist and can't stop climate change, was basically the thesis. And it's all about bringing in feminist art, and I'm not kidding, feminist art projects and indigenous mythology into glaciology, or else it's a perverted science and everybody who refuses is a bigot and blah, 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 a masculinist, a racist, and so on. And the paper made me so angry. This is in a high impact factor journal for people who follow academia. It's over, had a high impact factor higher than 7, which is very high. Most of your major journals have about a 2. Nature has like a 41 or something. So it gives you a range, a sense of the scale. But I was very upset. And then I find out it has $500,000 almost, like $480,000 or something of National Science Foundation money behind it. And I'm like, what in the world is this? What is going on? And so it's happening in the sciences, but usually the decolonization, and there's actually a thing, people should look this up. There's a video on YouTube that's shocking from South Africa called Science Must Fall, which is a part of the broader program that was called Rhodes Must Fall, which was to destroy the legacy of Cecil Rhodes, which may or may not be a valid project on its own for various reasons. But, you know, to go after Rhodes College and to go after the Rhodes Scholarship and to go after this whole idea using the not untrue accusations of racism to justify what they do in the Science Must Fall video that I encourage people to look up and watch. It's a few minutes long or up to an hour long if you want to watch the whole thing. They have a seminar saying that, you know, actual natural sciences displaces, you know, South African mythologies and wizardry, black magic, literally black magic beliefs that you can do certain rituals and summon lightning to strike somebody. And science says that that's not possible. And so that's actually an imposition of cultural values that has to be stopped. And so the natural sciences have to be rethought in their entirety and so on. And so this is a huge movement, but the typical vector is that they're going to wedge up something and then insert indigeneity or re-indigenizing the curriculum. So it's happening in all curricula, all the way across the board.
We'll be back with more Take Back Our Schools right after this.
This is Stephen Hayward of the Powerline blog and the Powerline show on Ricochet, inviting you to tune in each weekend to our 3 Whiskey Happy Hour, where John, you and I, along with the pseudonymous Lucretia, Powerline's international woman of mystery, break down the week's top stories and continue our long-running arguments about first principles, and also critique the best whiskeys available in the world. That's Powerline's 3 Whiskey Happy Hour, hosted by Ricochet, and found on all of your favorite podcast platforms.
I remember, funny enough, so it was a paper on, what was it, feminist glacialism?
Glaciology, yeah.
Glaciology, that you ended up publishing a number of hoax papers, which is when I started taking notice of your work, and then that led to, I guess, what you're doing today. So if parents see, what should parents be looking for in their kids' classrooms with respect to this? Like, what would a decolonized curricula look like? And then, moreover, what should they do? Like,
well, I mean, the first thing they're going to notice is that they're taking out certain kind of staple books. Those are going to be the things that you sort of notice first. You'll see,
which is really hard because now everything's getting yanked off the internet.
That's right. You'll see what Andrew said, which is subtle. You actually have to have some subtlety to notice some of this when it's not very overt. They might notice that their kids' math homework is a lot about like pattern weaving and all this. But Andrew pointed out, we spent 4 weeks on this and we spent a few days on that. You're going to see this kind of grotesque reprioritization. You're going to talk
about.
Well,
let me jump. One of the things I'll jump in really quickly. Like my daughter is in her former school that we pulled her out of. They had replaced 4 of the 5 books in the 7th grade reading list that they had read forever. So
that's right.
Get rid of the classic. Now, the one that they kept was the Odyssey. So they can still say they teach the Odyssey, except it is a brand new translation that reinterprets the entire book by a gender ideology lens.
Interesting.
So even though, so they're saying, oh, well, we still teach Homer, we still teach the Odyssey. And in fact, that is as much of the social justice curriculum as everything else they're doing. So it is really hard for parents.
They teach it at my kid's school. And for one of my kids, they taught the Odyssey through Freud's stages of development. Oof. So you talked about all of them and it kind of was a little bothersome to the kids. It was gross. I mean, some of the terminology that goes along with that. So
let's go back to how do parents, I mean, this is really hard for parents.
It's very hard.
It's hard
parents.
For us.
There's no easy answer either. Unfortunately, there's the parents in this country need to understand what's happening and take it very seriously. And we have to be real about it. We can't stop, if I might say so, pussyfooting around about this. We are undergoing a cultural revolution, exactly like Mao Zedong visited on China. That is what is happening. The structural parallels, it's not just similar, it's the playbook. It's identical. It's what how very famously Mao said that what he was doing was Marxism, Leninism with Chinese characteristics. We are doing a Maoist cultural revolution with American characteristics. That's why it uses race and gender and sexuality and so on, so it can fit into the American context, where it would not, we couldn't do naked socialism in America. It just wouldn't fly. It might in a few years, but it wouldn't yet even. So they have to use identity politics. Therefore, we are in wartime. You are a wartime mother. You are a wartime father, whether you like it or not. You didn't ask for it. You don't deserve it. I'm sorry that these are our circumstances. We didn't ask for them. We have to do what we have to do. Your children must be protected. You have to figure out how to educate them, probably what it means. And I try to paint this as positively as possible. And I know we're all busy and I know we have a lot going on. You don't have a higher calling than your children. You're going to have to spend more time with them. You have to forge the relationship with them. You have to get involved in their curriculum. You're going to have to help, bring actual curriculum to them. You're going to have to decode and diffuse some of this. I would love to see, I don't have the skill. People beg me to make this. I do not have the skill to develop like kind of modules, even if there's just short videos where parents could sit down with their kids and tie to what they're seeing in their schools to actual things like communism and make it clear what's happening and how important it is to protect your relationship with your parents, your relationship with your children, and vice versa, your relationship with yourself. And then also, what you have to do to guard yourself against these ideas because they're very seductive and they're very powerful and your social circles are going to be surrounded with them. Parents do not have very many good options. We have spent 50 years letting ourselves get a trap roped around us, at least on 3 sides. And there are, obviously when you're in that situation, if you go running in some new, oh, here's our salvation direction, it's probably also a trick.
Do you think parents should pull their kids?
In most cases, yes, I do. Unfortunately, I think there should be a gigantic protest against schools right now, across the board. I mean, I'm not necessarily even a huge advocate in general of homeschooling. I actually think that while it has certain benefits in a lot of ways, very many ways, honestly, I'm not going to buy that the majority of society is going to be willing to do it or want to do it.
It's too hard for most parents.
That's right.
I mean, there's a very small number of parents that can do it and do it successfully. It's just not viable for most.
There are also costs to it that, it has many benefits and many costs. And so there's a huge amount of trade-off involved. But for a period of time, as a gigantic revolt against what's happening in schools, I think that's necessary. I think with smart legal strategy, not blindly, we need to be looking into, there are statutes that already say that, that people acting in loco parentis, visiting negligent emotional and psychological harm on children, are legally liable. There needs to be action taken in those directions. My personal thought is that the first steps as a parent should be, if you believe you're in that situation, should not be to contact an attorney, but to contact your state's attorney general and start looking for guidance in the state level to say, can we find a way to make sure that these existing statutes are put in a place where parents can take action against schools that are harming? Because I think that this isn't a strategy to save your kid today. You're not like, the next lawsuits are slow. The justice system is slow. This is a few years. So you have to do other things immediately with your own children. But nothing will send a bigger shot across their bow or maybe sink their battleship than a few expensive lawsuits in a few school districts or against a few banner schools.
Do you think, I mean, we're seeing the gender and trans stuff that is, you know, excited in not a good way. Parents, I think there's more pushback. It's somewhat easier for parents to speak up about that. And the obviousness of the harm that schools are pushing on the gender and trans issues are so much more obvious than, let's say, on the race issues. Do you think those lawsuits and that legislation will come now because this is being exposed for what they are doing to kids and girls especially?
I think so. I think it's the most obvious avenue. I think, you know, smart, again, this is why I say attorney general guidance is so valuable. Smart attorneys general could be laying down guidance that explains that it's not CRT in schools, which is illegal in many of these red states now. Those, you know, attempts at legislation are maybe beneficial, but what they can serve as is a basis for discussing how the CRT leads to the kind of struggle session environment where those harms lie. But this is going to require, you know, quite a lot of legal architecture and theoretical architecture underneath it to get that built out. With the trans issue and the gender issue and the sexual confusion issue, that's not so much. But I will warn, there is a ticking clock on this. They have been attempting explicitly, with some measure of success, I mean, they've obviously started to infiltrate even medical journals now, not just their weird feminist journals. We have a clock ticking down to where they're redefining child developmental psychology. Developmental psychology, the real stuff, not dragging kids through Freud and in the Odyssey or whatever, the real deal would indicate how developmentally inappropriate it is to be bringing up sexual topics, to drag kids through the gross Freudian stuff, et cetera, that this is harmful on its own. But they've been working diligently to queer it for a number of years, as is said under queer theory, to, in other words, make it consistent with queer theory, to say that it's been an oppressive construct in and of itself this whole time that has to be revamped to talk about, in their terms, the differences between childhood innocence, which they wish openly, repeatedly say they wish to destroy, and what they compare it with, which is initiation into, in this case, sexual mysteries that are, you know, typically reserved for later teens and adults, often just, you know, parents discussing the talk with their kids, and then kids awkwardly kind of figuring out some of the stuff on their own because everybody is a little weird about that whole situation, and for freaking good reasons.
They want to break that down.
The thing is, especially when you're like prepubescent, sub 12, you're talking about stuff that's rampantly developmentally inappropriate. Even the aspects of hide it from your parents are the problem. This kind of stuff is rampantly destabilizing to children and their identity formation and all of this. And the avenue that to pursue this kind of litigation.
And that's deliberate. It's deliberate.
Of course it's deliberate.
Yeah. And so they're not waiting for the professionals to give them the guidelines to do this. I think schools are already initiating these conversations.
They are. But the problem is that organizations like WPATH, which, goodness, if I can remember what that means, World Something for Trans Health, the TH is Trans Health.
Is that a UN sponsored organization?
I don't know for sure if it is, okay. But these things are all tied together. I'll just leave it at that. But they're working very diligently to make not just guidance that some states are picking up, almost just like California, are almost picking up as is, but to turn those into standards of care. And if that happens, if that becomes issued as the state standard of care California is openly working on this currently, there will be a cascade effect across other states. Courts won't know what to do. The standards of care are what the standards of care say. This is why I say that we're under a ticking clock with this. And what would have to happen is that expertise in child developmental psychology and actual standards of care around these kinds of issues are going to have to be asserted, and they're going to be asserted firmly, and they're going to have to be asserted in a coordinated way. But you're also going to have expert advice coming down to give these AG guidances in expert testimony and witness, appearances in court. This is something that we actually have to take very seriously. It's nice to discredit the trans thing and talk about the trans thing and do meetings about the trans thing, but the rubber is going to hit the road on that with lawsuits, which I think is unavoidable. And they are already laying all of the intellectual foundation to circumvent that. So that's important. It's very important for parents to be aware of.
And on the trans issue, the good news is that Finland and Sweden and the UK and other countries are dialing back their approaches. And so hopefully that will help counter some of this.
That is a reservoir of being able to reach in with different ideas to say, look, no, California is flirting with this. All of established child developmental psychology until 5 years ago would have rejected everything they're saying. There's a deliberate attempt for them in their weird literature to, and I quote, queer and transform child developmental psychology. And Europe is saying, wait a minute, no, something is wrong. And so you can actually, smart people could make a very cohesive case that would be very persuasive. And again, this is why I think we need smart legal strategy before we just dive into, stupid lawsuits. And we would have to have, ideally, you start getting attorneys general, and in this case, maybe even state surgeon generals weighing in on these issues and making these things clear so that those lawsuits can start to proceed.
So, and actually your latest book started as an affidavit or some sort of document that you wrote for a legal purpose. And so the book is The Marxification of Education, if people want to grab that. And then where do people find you on Twitter?
I am at Conceptual James personally, and I'm pretty wild on Twitter, so enjoy the ride. And my company is called New Discourses. Its website is newdiscourses.com, and its identifier handle on social media is at New Discourses. So you can find it there.
And it is all of those resources chock full of information. And James, we just really appreciate you coming on this show to help shine a light on what's happening in our schools and, quite frankly, the world at large. And I think we referenced this earlier, you need to understand it in order to remedy the situation. So we hope parents will listen and dig in and learn more and challenge their schools and, most of all, get their kids in a learning environment that teaches them and prepares them to prosper in life, versus tear down the ideas and institutions that will facilitate their life. So thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
We covered a lot with James.
We sure did.
James can speak. I mean, James is so knowledgeable about everything woke education related and just woke related in general. I mean,
right. He's not only read all the books, but he retains the books and can reference the books. I mean, so really he is like his encyclopedic knowledge on this topic.
Yeah. And in terms of, deciphering the language, which is, such a challenge for all of us. I mean, for parents especially, but for all of us.
Absolutely. Well, and he puts it together. I mean, so that you can understand, like, yes, there are all of these players, but he can help you understand, okay, there was this influence of this, guy who wrote this book in the 80s, and it is manifesting itself in your child's classroom like this. So he helps you not only understand what has happened, but then what it looks like, because you really do need to understand that in order to address the problem.
But there's so, two, yeah. I talk about this. I mean, and you and I have had this conversation kind of off camera, off microphone. You have to kind of understand this a little bit differently. There's the ideological foundations, the philosophical foundations. I know James wouldn't like me using the word philosophical. The critical theorists, the Marcuse, the Ferrari, those people, Marx. And then you have, and that's infiltrated the education schools, which is now infiltrated education. But then there's the question of how how woke really how we let it happen. I mean, we can talk about conservatives being asleep at the wheel or giving up the ed schools or even giving up the liberal arts generally, but there really is more to the story. How did we let this take over almost every institution of our country? How did this take over, you know, Fortune 500 companies? How did this take over the government? How did this take over most of the mainstream media? It's not just ideology. There's a lot more there. And that, you know, it's something we can talk about in future episodes.
We should. No, I mean, I think it goes back to that long march through the institutions where this has been in the making for, you know, almost 100 years. But somebody poured gasoline on the fire, I think, recently. And so I think it would be interesting to go through and understand, you know, I think a lot of the foundations were laid, you know, or you had kindling and then the fire started and then it really started roaring. So yeah, no, we should absolutely address that in future. But this, he certainly helps you understand a lot of the, you know, the places where this began. So we'd again recommend the book.
Highly recommend. Right. I highly recommend his work.
Yep. Marxification of Education. So, all right. I think it's time. So thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoyed today's show. Please do share it. Give us a positive review if you liked it, and do please join us again. So on behalf of my co-host, Andrew Gutman, this is Beth Feely, and we'll be back soon with another episode of Take Back Our Schools.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.